This is hour number 3 of my interview with Josue Gonzalez on April 21st, 2015. So you mentioned the sort of shift to block grants, which came under the Reagan administration. Can you talk a little bit first about the tides turning? So 1980 is a time when Reagan gets voted in, and there's kind of, I don't know if you would call it a backlash or a...
Well, the first thing that...
new era of conservatism or...
Yeah. First thing he did, Reagan did when, I think the first day in office, is he had his people comb through all the Federal Register and find mandated things, mandates they call them, that didn't appear to comply with the Republican platforms, and declare those null and void. Lao programs were one of those. See, between education and the other agencies, there were 60 sets of mandatory federal programs that were eliminated in one day by...
By executive order?
Executive order. Yeah, because they were all not, they weren't declared, what were they? They were judged to be too strict, that they went too far, that the law did not mandate such things, and yet we were mandating them. I told you the story about the Dean's Grant program earlier, where we created this program to train bilingual professors. And we immediately got a call from the Hill, somebody saying, this is not correct. You don't have legislative authority to do this. I said, yeah, but I have authority to plan and take other measures, and that's what I'm doing, taking other measures. So I played that little game with them. But you can only do that once or twice before they catch up with you. There were several shifts in the Secretariat of Education. Barry was gone, she was a strong Democrat. And I think this was about the time that this fellow you were talking about earlier in New Mexico became undersecretary. That was his title. Some of these people were nice, and you could work with them and all that. Others were just rabid, anti-everything.
And your position shifted, too, because you were now out of the...
My position ended because we'd lost the election.
And you went...
And I was a Schedule C appointment.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to pack up and leave.
And that's when you went to George Mason University, is that right, in Virginia?
I had a part-time appointment at George Mason and a part-time appointment at National Council of La Raza.
Okay.
Helping them write proposals and things. I was forbidden by a new statute, which I don't know if it exists anymore or not, a person who was a Schedule C appointee in the government could not immediately turn around after leaving and apply for funds. So that was post-employment restrictions.
Mm.
And so I couldn't apply for Title VII, even though I knew how to do it. Because I had just come out of that office.
But at George Mason University, you were able to continue to work in the PhD fellowship program?
I was an advisor. I taught one class, and I was an advisor to this new program.
That was funded by Title VII?
It was funded by Title VII, but I wasn't running it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was not deriving any profit from it. I was paid... The university did something very interesting, George Mason. It was a university in search of an identity, because they compete heavily with the University of Virginia, especially in education. So they created a fund where every time there was a change in administration at the federal level and people were quote unquote freed up, they could go to George Mason and become a lecturer for a year while you got your bearings and while and at the same time help their students understand what was going on in the bureaucracy.
Smart.
Very smart and very cheap. It didn't cost a lot of money. So I don't have any big claims to anything while I was there. I helped advise young people who were pursuing a doctorate, and I taught one course, but that was it.
But in terms of, let me just ask you to reflect for a minute on the lessons learned aspect of this oral history. During your time in the federal government, did you, what worked on behalf of the causes you were advocating for? Was it these large national organizations, the states having any impact on, I'm just thinking in terms of how, where one can be effective in influencing educational policy?
Well, that's a different question. From what worked?
Right.
Or did it work? I always, this is an aside, I think. Every time I've been asked in the last 30 years, does bilingual education really work? I say, does monolingual education really work? Well, sometimes. I said, yeah, that's the same answer for bilingual education. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. You have to have well-trained teachers, you have to have materials, you have to have an orientation and a desire to do, to accommodate.
So let me rephrase the question then. Not what worked in bilingual education, but what worked in reaching the federal government to act? I mean, what advocacy efforts prompted action or responsiveness? Was it just enough voices and enough social movement, uprisings, grassroots?
I think, I think that what works best were things in which bilingual education was part of an orbiting set of things, all of which had similar ends to each other. Where bilingual education spun off and went on its own, it got lost in the shuffle. I think the advocates of bilingual education probably were looking for something more feasible that would work. They couldn't understand why would they be against this. This is good for kids. This is good for the country. This is good for your throat. I don't know, whatever.
Good for your what?
For
your
throat. If
yeah, so when you thought mandating this would be wonderful because it would actually force schools to deal with this issue, that went too far and it didn't have the general support that it needed.
Yeah, remember that until 1985, ESEA, until 1985, the big raging battle in Congress was states' rights in education. They could not, the people in the South could not stomach the idea that education, control of education was being lost to the feds. And that's what one of the reasons why Johnson said what he said. It truly was giving up. Not just because of bilingual, but in his case with civil rights legislation, which then picked up as a result of Equal Educational Opportunities Act, picked up language as one of the things that was supposed to be protected. Up to that point, language was not covered by civil rights legislation. It isn't very well covered now either, but there's a hanging by the fingernail sort of thing.
So you were just referring to something we talked about off the tape when you said Johnson, when he signed the Civil Rights Act, said he just lost
the South.
The South.
Yeah, yeah. So it in retrospect, it took us a long time to learn those things, but in retrospect, too, it didn't, because we didn't have any experience doing any of it. Mm-hmm. So we were, as we went, we were making stuff up. Mm-hmm. Like when I met with a director that followed me and said, look, these people are going to give you a lot of trouble. Let's have a drink and abolish them. Which was, it went kind of like that. Mm-hmm. She said, I'll drink to that.
But here you were in the 80s, you had been working very hard for over a decade now, and we were back to English-only conservatism at the federal level. How did the bilingual programs fare? I mean, did most states continue some form of programming?
I believe so. I think a lot of states, a lot of school districts, more so than a lot of states, continued it. You know, there's a phenomenon that my colleagues on this committee will certify to, and that is that big cities with their big school districts can essentially tell the feds to go to hell and get away with it. No, you know, no state that I can think of offhand that is like San Francisco, LA, New York, Philadelphia, all those big, the Council of Great City Schools. Have you heard of that? Okay. The Council of Great City Schools, in a sense, was established to fight for the rights of the big cities. Because if you didn't do that, they were afraid that when it came time to parse out the money, they would do it on a some sort of formula that did not help them. They wanted money to be distributed on a per capita basis, no matter what the program was. And they usually got away with it. I forgot the question.
The question was how this tide shifting towards English only affected language policy and bilingual education at the state level.
I think
local
bilingual
level.
Education persists at the state level. Perhaps in a smaller, very smaller level than it did before. But if you pick up the phone and call the school, LA Unified, and say, who's the person in charge of bilingual education? They'll put you right through. That person may not have a title or any authority or anything, but there's somebody called bilingual education.
So it didn't go away completely?
No.
No.
No. In fact, the ones that went away quickly were the bad ones because they didn't have a constituency to defend them. The good programs, for example, in Milwaukee had a really good program. There's a guy named Tony, I forget his name, who was a foreign language education person. And he loved languages, and he protected his programs, and I'm sure they're still at it. Mm-hmm. They're still doing it. Miami, no question they're still doing it. LA, New York, schools that you can walk into where no English is spoken. You know, it reflects the change, the demographic changes. Mm-hmm. no one that I know of has done a reassessment, you know, 20 years later, 20 years after the end of Title VII, what do we have to show, positive or negative? Even agreeing on the question would be tough to do.
So Title VII ended officially 82, what would you say? Or
you're going to have to look at the encyclopedia article by Jane Garcia.
Okay.
Because he was the last director of Title VII. And he probably has, I remember from the introduction to his piece that he had more...
I think it was 88, I misspoke.
Yeah.
How did you feel at that point in your career, having fought for a long time, that this was happening in the country? How did that... I mean...
Well,
where did you feel like you could make the most impact? You went then into the Chicago school system, right?
A year later, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I left in the Department of Education in January of 81. Hung around Washington for a year with the university and the National Council of La Raza. And then went to Chicago. Chicago was not a great experience. It's too politicized. But I spent 6, 7, 8 years on them, and then went over to the community college system. Because what I really always wanted to do from the time that I was a small kid, not so small, was to be a professor. That's what I really wanted to do. So when Title VII seemed to collapse, to find my way through and come out the other end with, as a college professor, which is what happened. I never lost hope that we were never again going to have something like Title VII. We may never again have it, but I don't know that we want it. Right now, if somebody said to me, take the 165 at the end of the last year and do something with it, buy some very high quality bilingual education programs that people can come and look at and learn how to do, I probably wouldn't have the energy to do but I might be able to convince Elsie or somebody else to do it.
Are there things you would do differently? I mean, even if you're just conceptually thinking about where the mistakes were or what lessons were learned.
My big number one mistake was everyone else's mistake, was treating every language groups as if they were amenable to the same treatments. They needed the same things. And that was not the case. So that erodes some of your political base. If you say the Greek-speaking people of Chicago want this, and somebody goes over there and asks them, you're going to find they don't. But they're counted in the non-English speaking roster.
So they may not want maintenance programs, for example.
They may not want either kind. Or the Native American. They wanted to find a way to preserve their languages and cultures. And that's great that they wanted that. But Title VII was not the proper vehicle with which to fund that. Yet there being no other, in one of the amendments, the reauthorizations, they slipped it in.
Not the proper vehicle because it was...
This one was about language restoration and language revival. In fact, the Navajos didn't have a written language, didn't have a dictionary. And with Title VII funding, they developed their own dictionary. And they now have a written language. Is that good? Probably. Is it really, really, really important? No. Because the title, the Navajo language will disappear sooner or later. There's no way you're going to save it. Any of the European languages, you don't need them. Because there's plenty of opportunities to learn Spanish and French and German and Italian and even Russian. Not too many places, but there are opportunities through the community colleges and so forth. So the Indian thing was something that you sort of rolled your eyes at. They were small grants. And they weren't wasted. You know, they did. Native American tribes are very careful about spending money. Really careful. So there was no danger that they were going to run off with something or another. The Cubans are still there. They probably don't need whatever support they're getting because they reformed a thriving middle class.
So how would you apply the monies today if you had it? You said that one of the mistakes was treating all language groups the same, like they all needed the same kinds of programming, or that was the assumption. Would you differentiate a bit more and do different kinds of programming?
Yes, and I would use technology to do it. Because here we have, where in the world is Carmen Sandiego? And people, things like that, that are begging to be used for instructional purposes. And those little programs, I don't watch enough of them, but I know they're there. Where there's, a little blonde-headed kid and a little dark-headed kid with darker skin, and they're slipping in respect for cultural identity. And every once in a while, Maria, or whatever her name is, will say something in Spanish. Mm-hmm. And the English-speaking kid will repeat it. And they're growing up with language and cultural diversity in a way that their parents didn't. And at some point, they too will become parents, and they too will want their kids, depending on what happens. It's also dependent on the crazy world that we live in.
Yeah.
There's never going to be a time in the foreseeable future where there's a mad rush of parents wanting their kids to learn Arabic. Ain't gonna happen. Uh-huh. Ain't gonna happen.
Maybe Chinese, though.
Chinese, yes. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Then you have the problem of which one, but...
Right. So what...
Japanese never caught on. There was, as far as I know, there was only one elementary school in the country, it happened to be in Chicago, that taught Japanese to young children. Mm. One. And this was at the time when Japan was the big, monstrous industrial place.
And in terms of sort of what you came to believe is the appropriate division of power or role between the feds and the states, a lot of the discussion has been, states control versus federal policy dictating, not necessarily curriculum content, but where do you fall along those lines in terms of states, federal use of their roles and what's appropriate? Or
well, I've been away from it for quite a while. I don't like a lot of the stuff that has happened that is retaliatory sort of. We passed a law here in Arizona that if you violated the restriction against home language instruction, you could be put in jail and lose your teacher certificate. Well, that's horseshit. There's no way that's going to happen. But they had to adapt it to show us who's in charge.
And that was a state policy.
What would I do differently?
I mean, in that case, would you think the federal role should come in as sort of protective of the civil rights aspect?
I like the experience of NDEA, National Defense Education Act. Immediately after Sputnik, the powers that be got together and said, what do we need to do to catch up to the Russians? And somebody said, teach more math, more physics, more foreign languages. That's what the Russians do. So it took off. And Elsie and I were both participants in one of those programs, or two of them. You were in Spanish, Elsie?
She's not in here.
I went to a French teacher's thing where they sent us 7 weeks to language academies around the country if you were a teacher of that language. So I went as a French teacher, very bad one. And for 7 weeks I spoke nothing but French, very intense. We had people from France living with us to keep us straight. And it was very, very helpful in improving our language. I like that model. I think that model, when you put it out in the open and you say, those of you who are interested in becoming X, Y, or Z, here's a program for you. And if you're not interested in it, there's something else over here that might work. It's like shopping for a car. Mm-hmm. What color and how much?
So providing the funding and providing the optional training.
And the problem with that is that we have the machinery in motion. We have the machinery of the states. All of the rest of the people that you're going to interview are going to tell you, give the money to the states. They're the ones that are the closest to the action. Yeah, but the states is also where the problem was. Segregation was not created by the federal government. And so on down the line.
So you need the federal government to protect civil rights, sort of as a top-down when the states aren't doing their job?
I would rather see people protecting themselves. More Latino lawyers to work with Latino organizations. And so Chinese and everything else. I think your communities would feel much more empowered if they did it themselves. Mm-hmm. The Indians do in this part of the country.
And so maybe a lesson learned in your story that I'm hearing is that when these big advocacy organizations organized, I mean, when they really had the support of activists, grassroots activists, they got stuff done.
Yeah, because they were in support roles. They were not, except for NABE, because NABE had its own legislative council. It was a guy who paid him a salary to keep an eye on Title VII legislation. And he was very good at it. But after a while, you know, it was going uphill all the time, and he was worn out. Mm-hmm. But I think to complete the sentence, I would want mechanisms set up to fund, I'd go back to Title III, elementary and innovative programs, and just put out a call to school deans of education and to state departments of education. Send me a 1 or 2 page thing that describes something that you would do if you had $80,000 to play with for a year. That's all the money there is. There is no more. And you're only going to get it for 1 year. So make it good. And I think we'd have some interesting proposals. Focus them in on those 4 or 5 Venn diagram or whatever that it looks like. Mm-hmm. focus them in on that, on those. Say, pick one of these, utilitarian or whatever. And put minimal requirements, like you can only link to one other program or two other programs funded under this provision. And that's it. The Dean's Grant Program taught me a big lesson. It was very, very late by the time we got around to offering it. But it was simplicity. It made 100% the first year, 2/3% the second year, and that's it. Then by that time, that person is on his way, her way, to tenure, or is out the door. And if he or she didn't make it to tenure because of this program, sorry. But we will not play an intervention role in that one. We just, it's got to be somebody who responds well to you, to your agency, to the teachers of this state, to the language groups present, to the civil rights people. In some of my other lives, I've worked with community-based organizations. I was the chairman of the board of the Latino Institute in Chicago, which was the largest Latino agency program in the city. I helped to found it, went away, came back, picked it up again. Now it's shut down, it's gone. Because what people tell you often is that you need expertise, program expertise. If you're going to do housing, you need to know about housing. If you're going to do education, you need to know about education. If you're going to do health, you need to know about health. No. I think if you're going to do any of those things, you just need to know. You just need to know when to move, where to move, how strong to move. Stay within the ballpark. Don't get off.
And there's also social forces, I think, that you mentioned that at some point, maybe it was the 2000s, early 2000s, a critical mass was reached just culturally of native Spanish speakers living in the U.S. and the media then.
I cannot tell you how my little heart went bumpity bump right into the microphone. when I saw the march in L.A. in March of 3 years ago, for the undocumented, when they all dressed in white and marched down the wow. And you know who activated that much? A radio disc jockey. Professional people would not have deigned to talk to this Looney Tunes, you know, guy. But he had enough clout to bring out into the streets of L.A. thousands of people all dressed in white. Nobody else had been able to do. And then after the thing was over, it fell out because that's what he was charged with doing. That's what he did. He wasn't founding a new political party. He wasn't advocating for bilingual education. He was focused on the undocumented, the case of the undocumented taxpayers, as I call them.
The undocumented taxpayers.
Yeah.
So what's the next move? I mean, that needs to happen. Or if you...
Well...
If you could wipe the slate clean, or you could start fresh, or you could have your way with what happens in terms of language policy in the U.S. We haven't even talked about No Child Left Behind, but...
I don't want to.
Okay.
In 1973, I gave a speech in Albuquerque, New Mexico that achieved some notoriety. And the biggest thing I think I said, because I went looking for it, I couldn't find it, was that bilingual education was being beaten around severely, that we faced some hard times, but that if we could hang on until the year 2000, we would be in the clear. Because by the year 2000, Spanish speakers would be so huge in number that the big powers that be could not possibly ignore us. 2015, mm-hmm. We have two Latinos running for office. I wouldn't give you a dime for either one of them.
But still
what? I mean, they won't help you. They won't help you. They are a distraction, because in Texas, you watch the returns election day. Mm-hmm. What do they do? I don't know. What this guy married a Latina. The grandpa liked to talk about his little brown grandchildren. They've pumped this guy full of Spanish. This young man who's slated to be the next Bush president. He's only in his 20s now, but he'll be there. The education of a potentially viable, useful, powerful, strong electorate is what societies like this one needs to have. Without it, we're going to be overrun by the heathens every time.
Overrun by the...
By the people who don't believe the things we believe in. Mm-hmm. That people should be healthy, that people should have enough to eat, that people should have, shouldn't have to sleep under bridges. And when you see the amount of money that is being spent on the military, for example, going, oh my God, that's incredible. That is incredible.
And keeps getting cut from education.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I saw, on my way out the house today, I was watching TV, just looking for news. And there was the military channel, they were showing this thing where in the 1950s, as they were testing the atomic bomb, the United States Navy took 90 huge boats. I mean, big ones. The USS Enterprise. I mean, And they piled them up in the middle of the ocean, and they dropped an atomic bomb on them just to see what would happen. What is 90? 90 of those super boats worth? Mm-hmm. Oh, well, they were no good anymore. They were so good that the big one, the USS Enterprise, suffered very little damage. They had to tow it to Japan and dismember it and then take the pieces and dump them in the middle of the ocean. Even an atomic bomb would not hurt those things.
Is there any other closing thoughts that you want to share? I mean, it sounds like it's a question of national priorities that need to change. And your hopes in terms of language policy in this country, and if you were to...
Well, I think the hope would be that someday people will have less trouble preserving their language heritage, and that children would have more options to do in school. If your kid needs to go across town to her school, there ought to be a way for her to get there. Because you're paying for the service. I mean, This is a public school. The second thing I would do is separate out of the conversation Spanish from all the other languages. That is not easy to do. The minute I start talking like that, I start losing some people. Because they say, no, this is a language rights issue. No, it's not. It's a language rights issue for those who can get language rights out of it. But otherwise, Why?
What do you mean separate Spanish out?
For purposes of the conversation on policy and program design. You know, you can't teach an Arabic child to write this way when in their language they write this way. Big difference. Your fingers don't move quite as readily.
Right, but in terms of separating Spanish out of the conversation on...
Find its uniqueness, is what I'm saying. Factor it out for purposes of policy conversation. Uh-huh. And then identify, instead of having one thing called bilingual education, I've been advocating, as I have with you, that we call it, you know, language policy issues in the schools, mm-hmm. and how the Japanese-speaking people in San Francisco have dealt with it versus the Spanish-speaking people in Miami versus Haitian Creole. Mm-hmm. And not, which is not to say to explode this budding alliance, which we've already tried. Didn't work. Instead of blowing it apart, we're talking about helping it come together with its differences. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, we're asking people to do the same thing that the English-speaking educational system has asked kids to do, which is to give up their home language and learn English. The current definition of bilingual education, transitional variety, asks the same thing practically. Mm-hmm. Okay. We need a new revised period of experimentation.
Right, which is sort of antithetical to standardization.
That's why right now I don't think we could do anything.
Because we're in such a standards environment.
And test and test and test.
Test to test. Right. The standards movement doesn't square that well with multicultural, right. Multilingual, multi-ethnic groups.
But you got some good people on that thing to interview on those subjects. Yeah.
Are there any other closing thoughts or things I haven't asked you? You'll have a chance to review the transcripts and add things that you feel are missing from the record. But other issues that concern you with regards to language policy, or do you think we've covered it?
Well, I think the big picture in language policy is language economics, the economics of all this. And we're going... In our state, we're this year going in the red for K-12 and for universities. Everything is going in the red.
Because there's not been enough money.
Because they cut the budget every time they want to reelect themselves. They cut the budget. And they don't care about the population because the population is... The same problem that the president is facing. You're a little too dark. And the kids in those schools are a little too dark.
So funding public education means funding
dark people
who look different than you.
And so. Who are not very successful in school to begin with. So why should we be pouring money in this bucket with a hole in it. Mm-hmm. We still don't know in the year 2015 which children learn in what ways and how can we spread the good practices within reasonable range. What they try to do out of Washington is to say, you know, let's identify what works and then let's get everybody to use it, to do it. Thank you for coming to the meeting. You're not going to find that because it doesn't exist.
Not one shoe fits all. Yeah. Thank you for letting me interview you.
My pleasure.